We welcome you to this edition of the Tuesday People podcast. I'm your host, Mitch Albom. This podcast inspired by the book Tuesdays with Maury, which I wrote now 25 years ago, lessons learned alongside my old college professor as he was dying from Lou Gehrig's disease, a book that was small and just supposed to pay his medical bills and went on to become something that I never could have anticipated, and now is read and embraced by people around the world. And so we do this podcast to talk about some of those lessons revisited on a weekly basis, our own sort of Tuesdays with all of you, and see how they hold up and pertain to today's world. Alongside, as always, is Lisa Goetsch, my good friend and producer. Lisa, nice to have you here.
Good morning, Mitch.
And we want to welcome a special guest to today's program. Many of you, if you read the book Tuesdays with Maury, know that while it's centered on Maury and Mai's relationship during that period of time before he died, Maury had family of his own, including two sons. And his oldest son, Jonathan Schwartz, is kind enough to join us for this week's edition of Tuesday People. John, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Mitch. How are you?
Good. Glad to have you with us. I don't know how much you've paid attention to the podcast or how much you know about it, but you and your family are spoken about often by our audience, and I think they appreciate getting a chance to hear from you directly.
Well, it's my pleasure. Honestly, I've only come to the podcast recently, but now that I know that it's here, it's really wonderful, especially when I hear recordings of Dad's voice. That's really special.
Yeah. How does that make you feel? I've often wondered about that, you and your brother Rob and your mom Charlotte. When you hear Maury's voice from, geez, now it's 25 years ago.
It's really special. It's there's such a gulf of time, and you carry, you know, various memories in your heart and in your soul, and you know, when you hear the voice again, it adds punctuation is an understatement, but it provides some substance that just is not there and is greatly missed. And so hearing the voice is actually quite moving. And you know, it puts me back in various rooms and circumstance and experience with Dad. So
now when I was visiting with him, it was, you know, somewhat formalized. I came every Tuesday. He knew I was coming. After the first few weeks, we sort of had this blueprint of just discussing a different topic every week. Eventually, as I've told you and Rob, your dad wanted me to write an honors thesis. That's what he thought we would do with the tapes. I didn't have the heart to go into the fact that I wasn't enrolled anywhere, so I don't really know how I would do an honors thesis or for whom. I think your dad just thought, well, he'll find some place to do an honors thesis, or maybe I'll get him to go back into graduate school. But eventually it became a book project towards the end of your dad's life, and then became Tuesdays with Maury. But each Tuesday we sort of had a plan, and I would come and I'd say, well, I want to talk about this subject. And he was up for that and was very into looking into the depth of a subject through the eyes of a man who realized his life was about to end. Your visits, on the other hand, I'm sure were quite different. When you had your whatever days of the week with Dad, not with Maury, and would sit and talk with him during those same months, the last 8 or 9 months of his life, what were your conversations mostly about?
Well, as you know, in your less formal talks, Dad really wanted to hear about life. He wanted to hear what was going on, what you were feeling, what your troubles were, because that was, you know, sort of the meat of existence, you know, the experience and sharing that experience. There's actually a really great little story that I like to tell people because I think it goes to the heart of what Dad, you know, liked to talk about. And if you don't mind, I'd like to just share that.
Sure.
So, When I was still working and living in Boston and sort of struggling with school and various aspects of life and my personal relationships, We had had a talk about drinking and that sort of thing. And this is where Dad really, I think, had insight for me. He never had a problem with anybody imbibing or anything, but he asked me a really important question, and I think it's very apropos for today, because we're all under so much pressure from and stress from various things. He said, "Jonathan, why do you feel you have to go through life in, you know, a euphoric or altered state? What is it that really is serving you in that capacity?" And he says, "Look, I'm not making a judgment. I'm not telling you what to do or what not to do. But if you had to ask yourself a question, ask that." And, you know, the conversation moved on. But that particular question comes back to me so frequently when I'm faced with various challenges and feel like I want to sort of run away from those because they're either uncomfortable or they're stressful or whatever. And then I think about what Dad said. It's like, you know, it's much the pain of the growth or the experience is far outweighs, in a positive sense, than anything else that I could do.
Right.
And so that's kind of the tenor of what Dad and I would talk about. We talk about life and how to manage that.
You know, he would frequently bring that type of a concept up about going through something in order to fully experience it. And of course, he was facing that himself, you know, going through the worry, going through the pain that ALS brought him, going through the mental cycle or depression of, I'm not going to live that much longer, and recognizing it for what it is. He called it detachment in the formal conversations with me about, you know, okay, look at it, look at your anger or look at your depression or look at your resentment, detach yourself from it and say, okay, that is anger. That is depression. That's what it feels like. I recognize that's what I'm going through. That's what I'm feeling. But I don't have to be a slave to that feeling forever. I'm recognizing it. I'm enduring it. But I'm going to put it aside and say that there are other feelings to come. And it sounds like in a less formal way, that's a little bit of what he was saying to you.
Oh, I would agree wholeheartedly. You know, he would say that, you know, you have to put in the work to get the reward. And part of that work is sort of confronting that thing that stymies you and realizing that it is not you. It's a construct either outside yourself based on somebody else's judgment or based on a feeling that you don't want to experience.
Right.
But he suggested that if you fully experience all of these things, that there is much more to be gained by sort of moving through them and getting to the other side than there is in trying to dull or avoid.
Right, run away from the
situations.
Pain. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interestingly, I pulled a couple of little clips here, and which I want to play for you. Maury and I were talking about how lenient a parent he was, or not, and he said this.
I had a principle against pushing them to study, you know, and I think that was a mistake. I think I should have pushed more at their, you know, doing learning and books and what have you, rather than being very sort of easygoing about that. I was very permissive. A certain amount of discipline and order is really quite important. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I did enough of that.
Did you encourage them to experiment socially when they were younger? Did you let them go out with girls as soon as they wanted? Were you strict about if they used marijuana or anything like that?
Well, I was halfway that way. I said, I don't want you to do it in the house. Uh-huh. Just do it. I don't care what you do out here. you stick up the house. What do you call it?
That's Dad.
That's the way you remember it too?
Absolutely. I think Dad, I don't remember a specific conversation about, you know, specifically imbibing in various substances. But I do remember the whole academic portion of this. And I think that if Dad and I had had an accord on sort of higher learning, if you will, was that neither of us pushed each other enough to go forward in a better way, you know. And so if there was any regret there, it would be that. And you know, I sometimes wish, actually frequently, I wish that Dad would have, been a little bit more forceful. Maybe our relationship wouldn't have been, at least at that time, all of that smooth. And I think he assuaged the pushing in favor of the smooth, because he himself wanted, relationship was so important to him.
Right. He didn't want conflict. Right.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Yeah. Relationship over accomplishment. And of course, your dad embodied that so many ways in his conversations with me.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
I wonder, every kid, especially boys, they look up to their dad as a figure of strength, leadership, guidance in who they are. To many boys, when they're growing up, their dad's their hero or a form of a superhero. Whether he's physically strong or not, that's not the point. The point is he's in control. If you had that as a boy, and even as a man, as it morphs as we get older, when your dad was stricken with ALS and you saw the physical decay and the need to be carried from place to place, I'm sure you did your share of that, the need to wipe his nose and reach down his throat and pull up phlegm and massage his back to try to get him to cough the stuff out of his system and maybe even wipe his rear end, all the things that people had to do for him. How did you as a son go through that vis-a-vis the image that we all want to have of our dad being strong and, you know, our own personal superhero?
So there are two aspects to this. And the first aspect is, as his body decayed, the spirit, at least, you know, in my view, grew stronger. And he was never more present than in his most physically diminished state. On the other side of that, when your father is standing in a walker because that's the only thing he can do to stand up, and you know, he said, you know, Jonathan, I gotta go to the bathroom and I can't do it myself. And so you know helping him to urinate, if you will, is it was in retrospect a positive experience that I could help him do it. But at the various times, it was probably the most painful and challenging thing that I've ever been through, because, you know, here is somebody that had been, although not physically powerful, but he'd been physically present because, you know, he loved to dance. You know, he loved to be, you know, in that moment in a very physical way. But now he couldn't, and he couldn't even help himself. And so, you know, it's just this enormously challenging experience to be with him in that respect.
Yeah.
So,
did he speak to you about that, as he did with me and others, to address it and say, don't be embarrassed. This is, as he said to me once, this is the carton I was shipped in. You know, this isn't me. You know, I'm inside. I'm in my eyes. Look in my eyes. Don't pay attention to this decaying body. Did he have to do that with you and Rob as well?
I can't speak for what he said to Rob, but you know, he didn't say that to me. He says, look, I don't want you. So, and this is where I think he was, his generosity was overwhelming. He said, look, if you don't want to do this, if you can't do this, if this is too painful, you know, you don't have to do that. You know, it's, we'll find a way for either someone else to help, and we'll get it done that way. And so, you know, the feelings that that statement brings up are many. You know, one of them is shame that I'm not helping my father. The other one is, you know, how should I be such afraid of someone that, you know, of doing something when, you know, quite frankly, when I was an infant, you know, it was wiping my ass. So,
right.
You know, I'm sorry if that was a crash.
No,
but,
no, I get it.
But he, you know, it comes full circle, and at the end of the day, it ended up being a matter of pride and feeling pride that I could help my father in his time of need, as he tried so valiantly and succeeded to help me through my, you know, my growing up.
Yeah. Was there one particular physical moment that you remember, an encounter between the two of you that stays with you sharply even to this day?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a physical encounter, but, you know, towards, before we knew he had ALS, he liked to have some private time with his boys. So he would take each, my brother and I, at least this is my recollection, he would take each of us on, you know, a vacation. Was just him and me, or him and Rob. And I remember talking about somebody that I was having, you know, just a tremendous problem with. And, you know, I was sitting at a dinner table with him, and I was just absolutely enraged because, you know, there seemed to be no way to resolve this without, you know, doing something that was totally inappropriate for everybody concerned. And he said, look, you can only control your own actions and feelings. You know, there's nothing else you have control over. And know that for this particular person, you know, I've had many of those feelings myself, but what I have to remember is everybody is who they are. And if you let them go, or you open your heart and let them, you know, be in your heart with love, then you'll know that it is not something that's done to you. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, this is all for you, whether you perceive it that way or not. And that was, and so sitting at that dinner, I went from this this moment of rage to this, you know, I can see that. I can move forward, because I'd never thought of sort of opening the heart, if you will, instead of just, I need to resolve this. I need to be, you know, forceful. That's the only way. And actually opening the heart softened the whole thing. Mm. So that was very important.
You know, you talk about the time that he gave to you and that he gave to Rob, your brother. I often wondered, because, you know, being at your house during those final months of Maury's life, and seeing, even on Tuesdays, which he reserved for me, but seeing the number of people who came before I got there, the number of people who came just as I was leaving, and then hearing the whole lineup of people who came on Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, it just seemed like such a revolving door of people, former students, co-workers, friends, family, Ted Koppel, people who wanted to interview him, you know, ever since the first Nightline program, and that went on for the better part of 8 months or so. Did you ever feel like, well, our father is being all things to all people, but, you know, we have limited time with him. We'd prefer to, you know, have more of him to ourselves?
No, you know, I never felt that, because one of the beauties of Dad was, you know, this is where his heart shone. This is where he was himself, and to see him sort of in his power and in his in presence, you know, that was uplifting, because now the demise of the body didn't matter. You know, it was, I reveled in that. It was a beautiful thing, you know, and I lived locally. I could go over the house anytime, and in fact did. And so I knew that there would, at least while he was alive, I would always have time with him.
Mm. You know, he also, selfishly, but. He spoke to me about not wanting to put on demands, and you've alluded to it already in some ways, on his family while he was going through his terminal illness. I'll play you a little cut of him saying that.
Fortunately, it doesn't all fall on them. With my heavy burden of, you know, distress at times, it's just on Charlotte or Rob or John. I have a principle that I don't make any more demands on anybody than they want to give, if at all possible sometimes, which means that applies all across the board, you know? So that Charlotte wants to go to bed at 10 o'clock because she's so exhausted, she goes to bed at 10 o'clock, you know? And if, even if I want to stay up and talk or something. And so I try to work out within my means, so to speak, some kind of balance between what is good for me and what is good for the other person, rather than that kind of, I'm so needy, and you've got to give everything, and I can give very little.
He seemed very concerned about not burdening the family too much with the disease, not wanting, for example, you were local, but Rob was living overseas, and he talked about not wanting to say to Rob, you need to move here for this last year, you know, I'm going to die and you need to be here. He said, I would never do that. I would never put that kind of pressure on him, because he didn't want, as he phrased it, ALS to destroy more than his life, you know, two lives, three lives, four lives. Did he express that to you that way, and how'd that make you feel?
You know, honestly, that particular conversation never came up, you know, other than it's like, you know, I know you have to work. I know you have to do these things for your own life. And so whatever you have to do for yourself, whether it's recreation, whether it's relationship related, you know, something else, you know, that's okay. And so I think that's how it manifested with me. He never actually said, I don't want to burden you. I don't want you to do anything that you don't want to. You know, it was more like, you know, live your life when you, and come visit. That's how he handled that with me specifically.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Did you ever have a goodbye type of moment or talk when it got close to the end?
No. Because I was over the house frequently, we just were sort of father and son or family as best we could, given his physical limitations. I think the whole process, once we found out he had ALS, I think every talk was kind of a goodbye, but there was no specific, I'm going to see you, because we didn't know when he was actually going to pass. And there was no sort of reason to say, well, I'm going to say goodbye now.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't seem to make sense. I always knew that he would be present whether he was there physically or not.
Do you regret now not having some kind of formal farewell sentence?
No, because, you know, right, even though his corporeal self has passed, you know, he's in my heart. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so he's ever present throughout my day, whether I'm with my wife, my puppies, my friends, my brother, my, you know, mom, you know, he's always there.
Yeah.
And I think there's no, call it faith, if you will. You know, my faith is that he's always there.
Yeah.
And those people that have been in my heart and continue to be, well, whether I pass or they pass, you know, we'll all be there.
Yeah, death ends a life, but not a relationship. That was his, he didn't originate the line, but he used it frequently. And it seems to repeat itself with everybody I ever meet or have met who knew your dad, including, of course, your family, that the relationship still goes on.
Oh, there's not a day goes by that I'm not sort of seeking his advice and finding it.
Well, you can find it in your heart, or you can find it on a library shelf in different places as well. I never had a chance to ask you in all the years we've known one another, but I'll ask you here now. Did the publication of Tuesdays with Maury and as a book and then its subsequent surprising reach, which, as you know well, none of us expected. This was not supposed to be the book that it became. Has that had any interesting or unusual repercussions for you as his son when people find out that you're Maury Schwartz's son, the Maury of Tuesdays with Maury? Does something kick in there? You have any anecdotes or things at times when people have noted that to you?
Well, there are two types of responses that I get when people find out. And the first one is, what was it like growing up with Dad? You know, you're either going to write a series of books to describe that, or you say, well, you know, it's like growing up with anybody's dad. You have all of these experiences, and that, you know, defines both you, him, and your relationship together. But the other thing that happens is, you know, I get this, you're Maury's son. Thank you for sharing him. And I said, well, you know, actually, you should thank Dad and you should thank Mitch, because, you know, it wasn't me that actually shared him. But, you know, the stories that people tell, it's like, wow, you know, my family member went through this and this book was such a comfort. Or I had some series of issues in my life and just reading about how Dad, you know, went through his life. Boy, that was such a boon. It was such an uplifting thing that, and so it just makes my heart sore when I hear that, because now I know that Dad is continuing to be who he was, even though his physical body is not here to have that conversation. Again, the spirit continues. I don't know if that answers your question.
But, no, it does. And I'm glad to hear there haven't been any weird moments either, you know, or people asking for your autograph or something like that. There can be some strange things when books are popular and they're turned into movies and plays and things like that. In all that, when you read the book, when you saw the film, if you saw the play, how did all that make you feel just in that here was your father in this other form, you know, on pages of a book or on a screen played by Jack Lemmon or on a off-Broadway stage or things like that? Was there any weird reaction to that?
So first of all, full disclosure, I was not able to read the book after it was published. I was only, even though I saw a galley of the book, I couldn't bring myself to read it then. Sure. So it took me 2 years before I actually could read the book. And when I did, it's like, wow, it's like I'm talking with Dad again. So the book itself was, became very, very important to me. The movie, and I understand why they made some of the choices they did to, depict the whole situation. I was very happy that, they chose Jack Lemmon and Hank Azaria and the woman that played Mom is eluding me, and I can't remember who played Janine in the movie, but other than the actors and some of the dialogue, I the movie made me angry.
Really?
Because, well, it just seemed to be so far removed from either the book, or it wasn't personal enough, I guess.
Yeah.
There's something about movies for me that I take very personally, and it just hit me the wrong way. That's not to say that it's bad. I'm making no judgment. I'm just telling you how I feel about it.
Sure.
The play was fantastic.
Yeah, the play was and is wonderful. It's still being performed so many times in different languages and all around the world. But again, the play was very intimate. It was very much like what happened. And of course, I co-wrote the play, so there's probably a reason for that. I didn't write the movie. I really wasn't involved with the making of the film. But I had the same attitude. I understand that films are going to be different, and I thought the film was wonderful in its own way. Just it wasn't reflective of exactly what took place. But I probably had learned a little earlier than that not to expect that from films, because I'd been involved with the making of some of them, so I sort of knew.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
I do want to ask you before we let you go, I found after losing my father a few years ago, I find myself hearing his voice in me, and I sound like my dad sounded. I have a similar voice, and I find the expressions I end up saying and the way things I end up thinking, and I realize, wow, this is what they mean by, you become your parents, when you get to a certain age. I just find myself saying the same expressions and using the same tone of voice. Do you find yourself ever channeling your dad, Maury? And if so, in what ways are you like him?
the first thing is that when things are going really well, either for yourself, I hear this all the time because he used to say this all the time, and it's like, now you're cooking with gas. And given where he grew up, you know, cooking with gas would have, you know, had a whole new connotation instead of cooking with coal. But that means, you know, you've made it somewhere.
Yeah.
So in that sense, all these little sayings that he has, like, you know, when something is no good and you know, it's like gunug, no more, you know, growing up in the Bronx and, you know, speaking Yiddish for most of his younger life. So all of these little phrases come back, and I don't necessarily say them, but when I hear them, it's like, oh, Dad just showed up.
Yeah. Well, when they start coming out of your mouth, that's when you realize, oh, I've taken full root. I've come full circle. I'm telling people they're cooking with gas. And I'm saying, gunug, I think, is Yiddish for enough. And
exactly.
Yeah, you start spouting that. Yeah, you really, well, you could do a lot worse, John, than to sound like your dad and to channel your dad, because he's so beloved. And I'm so glad that we're able to do on this podcast what you alluded to at the start, is to hear his voice. That was really what motivated me to do this podcast and pushed me over the edge of, you know, been approached to do podcasts on different subjects. And I always thought, well, yeah, how much more does the world need to hear me talking? But when I had your dad's voice with all these tapes, I mean, it's just got so many tapes of our conversations. I thought, well, there's something that people haven't heard. So I'm happy to share them with the world, and I'm so happy to share them with you and play some of his just amazing conversations to bring him back and bring him back to you. Let me end by asking you, what thing do you personally, as his son, miss the most about Maury Schwartz?
Oh, boy. Just being able to sit down with him and give him a hug. You know, there's something about being able to hug your dad and have him hug you back. And then, you know, whatever is happening, it's all going to be okay. And so I think that's the thing that I miss the most. Not anything he said or did specifically, except for that hug. And that would be it.
I think you spoke very specifically about Maury and very generally about all of us who loved our dads and would love to get another hug. Jonathan Schwartz lives in Texas these days, in case people are wondering. And how old are you, John?
I just turned 61. So
just turned 61.
It's getting up there for me, too.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the program, John. And it only makes me wonder now why I didn't do this sooner. We've gone almost a year, and it just sort of occurred. Actually, I have to credit Lisa. Lisa was the one who sort of came up and said, why aren't we talking to Maury's sons on the podcast? I said, that is a really obvious question. And, you know, about a day later, I contacted you. So I'm so glad we were able to have you on and share some memories. And I thank you for being so generous. All your family was so generous in sharing your time that you had with your dad with me to, you know, before it was ever going to be a book or a movie or a podcast, it was just a former student coming, you know, halfway across the country to spend Tuesdays with your dad. And that took away time from that he had with you guys. And I always would thank you guys, and you would say, don't thank us. And you'd dismiss me. But all these years later, I still feel the same way. And I want you to know my appreciation.
And I appreciate that very much. And it is a pleasure to be on the show, Mitch, and I really have to thank you for, you know, helping to bring the book to its fruition, because we now have, or at least I have, I can't speak for anybody else, but I have, you know, the benefit of Dad's wisdom in something that is palpable. You know, it's nothing like hard copy.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's but this this is wonderful. And if you want to do another one of these, we can talk about, you know, Dad's anecdotes and things. And I would be more than happy to provide more input experience.
That would be great.
As time allows.
Well, you're officially one of the Tuesday people here now, John. So you're in the club, so you're welcome back at any time. And I thank you for spending some time with us, and wish you best of luck as we continue through this crazy 2020 year.
Thank you, Mitch. I really appreciate it. And I hope you stay safe and well, and give my love to Jimmy, please.
I sure will. That's going to wrap it up for today's edition of Tuesday People. You can check us out on the web at WeTuesdayPeople.com. Find out about all our conversations, join in talking about topics, and share your thoughts about our interview today. And as always, we will be back soon. On behalf of Lisa Goich, my friend and producer, this is Mitch Albom saying, see you next Tuesday.
Thank you for listening to Tuesday People. To be part of our conversation, join the Tuesday People community at WeTuesdayPeople.com. Subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss an episode, and share it with your friends. We look forward to having you with us every Tuesday because, after all, we're Tuesday people.